Up next from Mineral Acquisition Partners, Professor Amory Lovins, co-founder of Rocky Mountain Institute, shares his ideas for designing vehicles that are energy efficient. For your convenience, Amory Lovins' lectures have been divided into different parts. This is part one of a two-part lecture on social innovation conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation at the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're excited to introduce a new presentation in our MAP Energy series.
Amory Lovins was a MAP Ming Visiting Professor for Energy and the Environment at Stanford. This lecture series was sponsored by MAP as part of its commitment to fostering sustainable energy education. For more information, visit MAP online at maproyalty.com. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
And now, here is our presentation from MAP.
I want to welcome all of you here this evening. My name is Ralph Cavanna. My role will be to provide a brief introduction to the speaker, but you're now here in the midpoint of the five public lectures by our current MAP Ming Visiting Professor on Energy and the Environment. Monday and Tuesday we're on buildings and industry and Amory's continuing exploration of energy efficiency, opportunities, technologies, policies, barriers. Tonight he'll take on transportation. And in telling you a little about him, I face the challenge of introducing one of a handful of international celebrities who is instantly recognizable by his first name. And I thought that I would rise to that by simply telling you a story about Amory and the transportation issue. The Rocky Mountain Institute, which has many friends in this room, was founded 25 years ago, I want you all to remember. And when it was founded, its principal signature issues were really the issues that Amory covered in his first two lectures on Monday and Tuesday, energy efficiency in buildings and industry. The Rocky Mountain Institute had vehicles. It had a really nifty building. The vehicles were, to be kind, unexceptional. One of the RMI founders routinely drove around in a Ford 150 pickup truck, which Amory somewhat defensively, I thought, once described in a published interview as, quote, surprisingly efficient, unquote. But again, this was not their strength. And then in 1991, something important happened. The National Academy of Sciences was directed by the Congress of the United States to explore the technical potential for improving the fuel economy of passenger vehicles, about which nothing had been done basically since 1975. And the Academy decided to have a kind of science trial at its facility in Irvine, California. This was put together rather quickly, over a period of less than a month. The anti-fuel economy side was represented essentially by the world's automakers, who assembled their general counsels and their senior scientists, a formidable array, a small army of experts bristling with credentials. The pro-fuel economy side had none of that, and lacking anything else obvious to do, we of course called Amory. This was a preposterous thing to do. Amory had no formal training or visible credentials in this area. Amory had less than 1 month to prepare. Amory appeared and essentially over the course of a week, in something that I really wish all of you could have seen, took on the assembled experts and general counsels of the world's auto industry and brought them to their collective knees. They were, of course, wholly overmatched. They have been wholly overmatched ever since, except recognizing this, most of them have now hired Amory to assist them in what I hope, I think all of us can see, well, all of you will be convinced by the end of the evening, is a vastly more hopeful future than the one we were confronting in 1991. Amory will now provide for you an updated version of what some of us saw for the first time in 1991. You're in for a treat. Amory Lovins.
Through Ralph's invitation to that event that I fell in with the industry. GM's head of advanced engineering was sitting in the back at that event. He was interested in my ideas. We had lunch. On a handshake, he brought me into design studio to see the still half clay ultralight concept car, which was pretty much what I'd been talking about. And there followed an interesting relationship in which for a couple of years, GM graciously took my car education in hand. I gave them a bunch of good ideas. And when it became clear that it needed a broader stage, I then took what had turned into the hypercar concept. I put it in the public domain so nobody could patent it, fomented lots of competition in exploiting its commercial advantages, thereby amplified our $3 million R&D investment by a factor of roughly 3,000, things have been pretty busy since then. Let me start just with a benchmark number from my colleague, retired Navy nuclear sub-captain Scott Pugh. He points out that the cubic mile of oil that the world consumes each year, 85 million barrels a day, can actually be visualized and not just as a cubic mile. Another way he suggests to do it, because you can't really visualize 85 million barrels of oil, but he says take a barrel, it's 20 inches in diameter, it's 30 inches high. Now, lay it down on its side, put 85 million of them end to end. They will stretch 1.5 times around the world at the equator. And now take out all the ends, so it's simply a 20-inch pipeline 1.5 times around the world. And to get 85 million barrels to flow that distance in 24 hours, they have to be going at Mach 2, twice the speed of sound. That helps you visualize that much oil flow. And this naturally gives rise to various problems. So a lot of unlikely folks have been popping up lately to say we got to do something else for many good reasons. But I want to start with a little bit of economic history. In 1850, the fifth biggest industry in the United States was whaling, and most houses were lit with whale oil. But as whales gradually got shy and scarce, and first the sperm whales and then the other kinds started to get pretty hard to find, the price of whale oil drifted up, eliciting competition from a lot of things, but most of all, oil and gas, both made at the time from coal. Remember, this is long before Edison's electric light. And in the 9 years before Drake struck oil in Pennsylvania in 1859, that competition grabbed away from whale oil over 5/6 of the lighting market. The whalers were astounded to run out of customers before they ran out of whales. They hadn't been paying any attention to the competition. They were soon reduced to begging for federal subsidies on national security grounds, and the remnant whale populations were saved by technological innovators and profit-maximizing capitalists. Now, this is a little like where we are today with oil. To be sure, the time constants are smaller. It isn't just a matter of an easy screw-in retrofit to change your whale oil lamp to a coal oil lamp. But we have vehicle fleets that take longer to turn over. Nonetheless, the same basic dynamic is at work, because we've spent several decades now amassing a huge portfolio of very powerful technologies for saving oil and substituting for oil, and no one had bothered to add them up before. But when my team did in 2004, we found that they were more than enough to replace all the oil that we now use in this country at roughly a fifth the cost of buying it at today's price, assuming its externalities, its hidden costs, are worth zero, a conservatively low estimate. So my wildcatters have been out drilling lately, and they found 8.3 million barrels a day in an undrilled play under the Detroit Formation. And they found 1.6 million barrels a day in heavy trucks, and 1.2 in industrial fuels and feedstocks and so on. Altogether, a huge amount of nega barrels down there, savable oil, plus a big play in robustly competitive biofuels, and 12 trillion cubic feet a day of gas that we found in places like air conditioners. More on that later. So shouldn't we drill the most prospective plays first? I mean, wouldn't it be kind of embarrassing to go to the ends of the earth to drill for very expensive oil that might not even be there, and somebody else finds all that oil lurking under Detroit? So in 2004, we published a detailed study that's independent and peer-reviewed. All the numbers are clearly laid out. Nobody's argued with it. And it was co-sponsored by the Office of the Secretary of Defense and the Chief of Naval Research, written for business and military leaders, not for politicians. They can hear about it in due course from their constituents. And we built the argument around competitive strategy business cases for cars, trucks, planes, fuels, and military. You can get the whole book and all its 24 technical backup annexes free at oilendgame.com. And its thesis is arrestingly simple, that over the next few decades, say by the 2040s, this country can eliminate its use of oil and have a much stronger economy, and that transition will be led by business for profit. Here's what it might look like. The upper red curve is the use of oil, the lower dashed red line is the imports of oil to the United States, and in the official forecast, they keep heading toward the northeast corner. But we showed how to turn these curves downwards along the green curve by redoubling the efficiency of using oil, already doubled since 1975. And it turns out that in year $2,000, the cost of saving a barrel would average $12. Then we could turn down steeply along the blue curves by replacing the other half of the oil at an average cost of $18 a barrel with a mixture of saved natural gas and advanced biofuels, mainly cellulosic ethanol. Now, we know this sort of thing works in principle because we've done it before. Look at this even steeper drop. The last time we paid attention to oil, 1977 to 85. In those 8 years, GDP grew 27%, while oil use fell 17%. Oil imports fell by half. Oil imports from the Persian Gulf fell by 87%, and would have been gone in one more year if we'd kept that up. In fact, the world saved so much oil so quickly that it cut OPEC's exports in half in 8 years, and it broke their pricing power for a decade, because we customers turned out to have more market power than the oil supply cartel. We, especially in America, the Saudi Arabia of negabarrels, could save oil faster than OPEC could conveniently sell less oil. Well, that was then, this is now, you are here, but we could run that old play all over again a lot better with today's much more powerful technologies. Now, suppose that from now till 2025, we were to invest $180 billion once, half of it to retool the car, truck, and plane industries, half of it to build a modern biofuels industry. And suppose that that so softened the world oil market, as it well might, that the oil price went down to $26 a barrel, which was indeed the official forecast when we were writing the book. But against a $26 oil price, that $180 billion investment would be saving $155 billion a year gross, $70 billion a year net. At the same time, as a free byproduct, it would cut America's CO2 emissions by 26%. It would get us a million new jobs, mainly in rural and small town America, doing the biofuels. And we'd get to save a million jobs now at risk, mainly in automaking, where we have a really simple choice. Do we want to keep importing efficient cars to displace oil, or do we want to make efficient cars and import neither the oil nor the cars? That somehow sounds like a better idea. We found the business case for these actions is so compelling that this strategy could be implemented without new fuel taxes, subsidies, mandates, federal laws, or anything else either party doesn't like or could mess up. That is, such public policy as is desirable to support rather than distort the business logic could all be done administratively or at a state level. Now, technologically, the nub of the problem is, of course, transportation. Vehicles use 70% of the oil. But we found that a common technological strategy of low mass, low drag, and advanced propulsion could triple the efficiency of cars with a 2-year payback, trucks with a 1-year payback, and planes with a 4 or 5-year payback. Often with improved performance, for example, this Opel carbon fiber diesel hybrid Eco Speedster would get 150 miles an hour and 94 miles a gallon, although not at the same instant. And the surprise to many is that the ultralighting that doubles the efficiency of these carbon fiber concept cars is free, because the cost of their materials, as I'll explain, are paid for by simpler automaking and a two or three times smaller propulsion system. There are, of course, other big savings in buildings and industry, but I've talked about those the last two nights and won't revisit them here. Let me concentrate just on cars, then on trucks and planes. And the technology for all of these kinds of efficiency is continuing to improve faster than we use it up, so that efficiency, unlike oil, is an ever bigger and cheaper resource. The projected increase in the use of oil in this country to 2025, 70% of it is from light trucks and heavy trucks. So you won't be surprised that I'm going to say a bit about both of those. You can see the use projected for cars is essentially flat, and the second biggest growth area after trucks is air travel. Now, just a word on basic automotive physics, because I know there are a number of engineers and physical scientists in the house. The powertrain efficiency from the fuel in your tank to the wheels of a car or light truck is the product of the fuel-to-work efficiency of the engine times the work-to-output torque efficiency of the mechanical part of the engine, as opposed to the thermodynamics, times the driveline efficiency in transmitting torque from the engine to the wheels. And with an auto engine running on gasoline as opposed to the somewhat more efficient diesel, this works out to about 17%, although a modern Prius hybrid does about twice that well, if you drive it properly rather than the way Consumer Reports says to. Now, the vehicle load, what it takes to move the vehicle, technically known as the tractive load, is almost all of the energy that you have to get out of the fuel, but a few percent is to run accessories, air conditioning, lights, entertainment, and so on. And the tractive load, in approximate terms, in instantaneous mechanical power, has four elements. The inertia is what it takes to accelerate the car. That depends on its weight. It's F equals ma. The rolling resistance experienced by the tires, that again depends on the efficiency of the tires and how hard you press down on them, which again depends on weight. Aerodynamic drag rises as the cube of speed, and if you're climbing a hill, then you have to allow for that too. I'm going to neglect it from here on the assumption that uphill and downhill balance over time. And actually, both the inertial and the grade loads can be negative if you go downhill or you decelerate, and a Prius, for example, recovers two-thirds of that, or recovers that energy with an efficiency of two-thirds from wheel to wheel. Now, it only takes about 6 mechanical kilowatts of tractive load to run a Taurus, which is equivalent to two-thirds of a gallon per 100 miles. 100 miles per two-thirds of a gallon, that's awfully good. But you have to divide by this powertrain efficiency, so it's 6 times worse than that. And the important thing to remember about this physics lesson is that you cannot make the powertrain more efficient than 100%, but you can reduce the tractive load almost without limit by making the car lighter and more slippery. A lot of jurisdictions are asking us to reduce it considerably. If you look at the grams of carbon dioxide per kilometer emitted by a car, U.S. efficiency standards, if converted to that interpretation, are almost static, although California is trying to improve them radically, but not yet as radically as, say, China, let alone Europe or Japan. By the way, a Prius is down here. Notice the broken scale, that's 100. And I think the U.S. Laggard position comes about from the basic assumption held by most people who make cars or car policy that to make cars efficient, they have to be squinchy, unsafe, sluggish, costly, ugly. You wouldn't really want one. And then the government has to induce you to buy this compromised vehicle anyway through either efficiency standards or high gasoline taxes. And of course, the titanic lobbies behind these two positions, automakers favoring high gasoline taxes, oil companies favoring high CAFE standards, have battled each other to a draw for over 20 years. But there's another way to think about technological change. How many of you still buy phonograph records as opposed to digital media or cathode ray tube televisions instead of flat screens? You see, when you improve the technology enough, you can do an engineering end run around normal considerations just by redefining market expectations. So you'd want to buy the super efficient car, efficient as a byproduct of breakthrough engineering, because it's better, not because it's efficient. And that would give the automakers a much more robust business model, because they would only need to worry about competitive superiority rather than about random variables they can't control, like oil price and public policy. So to see how to do this, let's just look at the physics of where the gasoline energy goes, bearing in mind that your car every day burns roughly 100 times its own weight in ancient plants. Well, 7/8 of that precious energy never gets to the wheels. It's lost in the engine, idling, driveline, and accessories. Of the 1/8 that does reach the wheels, half of it either heats the tires and road or heats the air that the car pushes aside, and only the last 6% actually accelerates the car and then heats the brakes when you stop. But since only 5% of the mass you're accelerating is you, the other 95% is the car, only 5% of 6%, or 0.3% of the fuel energy ends up moving the driver. After 120 years of devoted engineering effort, this is not very gratifying. However, the good news is that 3/4 of the tractive load, what it takes to move the car, is caused by its weight. And every unit of energy you can save at the wheels will save an additional 7 units of energy you don't need to waste getting it to the wheels. So there's big leverage in making the car a lot lighter weight. That's not where we are headed, because we forgot what Henry Ford told us about weight may be desirable in a steamroller, but nowhere else. The most beautiful things in the world are those from which all excess weight has been eliminated. Whenever anyone suggests to me I might increase weight or add a part, I look into decreasing weight and eliminating a part. So if you find the way backward to Henry Ford, we'll have a lot of wisdom to work from. And we have a lot of relearning to do, because here's what's been happening to the weight of cars sold in the United States, cars and light trucks, actually. They now average over 2 tons. And we even looked, thanks to our analyst, Laura Shule, at something I hadn't seen graphed before, which is the density of cars and vans, namely their curb weight divided by their interior volume. You notice it's been going up. Density? How does that help anything? And 70% of this increase in weight that we're seeing is due to design and materials, only 30% to changes in the size and the mix of vehicles bought. Well, if you want to make cars lighter to capture the basic physics advantage, there are 3 broad things you can make it out of. Light metals like aluminum, which are perfectly feasible, a bit more expensive. New generations of light steel, special alloys, and heat treatment. Or the strongest and lightest solution, advanced composites reinforced, for example, with carbon fiber. That's what this handmade SLR McLaren from Mercedes is made of. It happened to get T-boned by a Golf, which was totaled. All that happened to the McLaren is it popped off a side panel, which they'll pop back on and fix the scratch later. But if you were to look under the hood, you would find at the front corners, there's a pair of about 7.5 pound woven carbon fiber crush cones. And to crush these down into a kind of a plastic cow patty takes so much energy that these cones, weighing only 0.25% as much as the car, can absorb the entire crash energy of the car hitting a wall at about 65 miles an hour. That, by the way, is with a thermoset composite like epoxy, which absorbs only half the crash energy per pound of a thermoplastic composite, which I'll be talking about, that absorbs 12 times the crash energy of steel per pound, and it does so more smoothly, so you can use the crush length or stroke up to twice as effectively. So with such magic strong but light materials that decouple size from weight, you just solve the safety riddle. That is, you can make cars big, which is protective and comfortable, without also making them heavy, which is hostile and inefficient. Therefore, you can save oil and lives and indeed money all at the same time. Anybody who follows the Formula One race world knows about this. Here's a shot of Catherine Legg running into a wall in an ultralight carbon fiber car at 180 miles an hour. By the way, her car is made of epoxy carbon or thermoset, which is subject to brittle fracture, and it's not nearly as tough as our thermoplastics. But, you know, that's not very promising with a person in
there. And the best news is that Catherine Legg has walked out of the medical center under your own power. How are you feeling?
A bit shaken, but I'm okay, as you can see. Oh, sorry. All my bits are intact, so it's good. Goes to show how strong their cars are.
Where do you have some injuries?
Oh, I just banged my knee. Car upside down, you bang your legs on the bulkhead and on the steering column and stuff. So just a bit of bruising, which won't look too attractive in my dress in the Atlantic's banquet tonight. But
In fact, Tom Friedman, in a film called Addicted to Oil on the Discovery Channel, was playing with some of these materials in the lab of a little company called Fiberforge that spun off from RMI. And first of all, he took the most complex and highly loaded body part and, we've lost our sound, and showed that he could lift it with one hand.
I can't lift this. Sure you could. It's not steel, it's carbon fiber.
Whoa! I'm strong, I'm not that strong.
And then he tried to do some damage to this piece of material, which is actually tougher than titanium.
So here's the part we just formed, Tom. Once it's trimmed, it can look just like these other parts.
You say these things are tough, right?
Oh, they're very tough.
I was gonna say, just how tough. I'm going to break one of these. Just plastic.
You want to try jumping on it?
Sure.
Here, why don't you try jumping on the floor?
Somebody got a bigger hammer? Here, give me that. Darn it.
So you can see that plastics have changed since the graduate. Now, even with old materials, with cars made of steel, by the way, the nationwide data confirm that size makes you safer, weight doesn't. You've probably seen a lot of press reports of government studies saying that if you make cars 100 pound lighter, you'd kill hundreds or over 1,000 more people a year in the U.S. But that analyst assumed that size and weight are equivalent. He only looked at weight and assumed that size came along for the ride. But actually, some other analysts using exactly the same database teased out size from weight and found that if you made the cars longer at the same weight, if you made the cars shorter at the same weight, if you reduce size, you would kill more people. But if you made the cars lighter at the same size, you would actually save more lives. Very clear result. And therefore, making cars bigger but lighter with strong materials and integrative design is the way to save lives and fuel. Now, the problem with these advanced composite materials has always been cost. We use them a lot in military and aerospace at about 1,000 times lower production volume and higher cost than you would need for ordinary cars. In fact, the advanced composite market in the U.S. is about as big in tons as the chocolate market. This is pretty specialized stuff. But then I got encouraged about maybe bridging this cost gap when I met a young engineer at the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works, where they make the not-quite-impossible military aircraft. And he had led a team that in the mid-90s had designed an advanced tactical fighter plane airframe that was 95% carbon, one-third lighter, but two-thirds cheaper, because it was designed to be made optimally out of carbon, not metal. Well, it was so weird he couldn't find a military customer for it, so one bounce later I was able to hire him to lead a similar effort for cars, which we did. And the result was an uncompromised, competitively priced 3.5 to 6 times more efficient midsize SUV done as a virtual design with two Tier 1 partners in Europe in 8 months in the year 2000 for about $3 million. And here's what it looks like. This is a five-seat mid-sized suburban assault vehicle weighing a little less than half as much as the equivalent steel vehicle, because it would be made out of carbon fiber composites. 0 to 60 in 8.2 seconds, 114 miles a gallon on hydrogen fuel cell, or if you ran it on a gasoline hybrid like a Prius engine, it would do 0 to 60 in 7.1 seconds and 67 miles a gallon on gasoline. And that version would have an extra sticker price of $2,500 as we ascertained from actual bids for parts, as I'll tell you later. That would pay back in under 2 years at U.S. gasoline prices. So this was production costed, manufacturable, and it can look like whatever you want. This is what's called in the trade the active outdoor lifestyles Gen X, Gen Y crossover vehicle at a time when crossover vehicles were kind of a gleam in the eye. Now there are a lot of things on the road that look very much like this. We're flattered. If you were to fold down the right seats instead of the rear seats, it gets so cavernous you can put in two full-sized kayaks and two people. We'd prefer to control and steer it with a right or a left side stick, or if you're British or Japanese, you can stick them on the right. There's a virtual display, everything by wire or by fiber, all functionality in software. It's a computer with wheels, not a car with chips. Sony PlayStation 10, way cool. But it has some other interesting attributes. I mean, if all U.S. cars were this efficient, cars and light trucks, it would be like finding a Saudi Arabia under Detroit. And worldwide, the potential from this kind of efficiency is as much oil saved as OPEC now sells. So that's a big deal. And again, to get back to the physics, an ordinary car takes about a liter of fuel to drive 12 kilometers on level city streets. But you see, only, in this case, about 12% gets to the wheels. Now, the industry has always focused on the losses, 85% loss or so, in the powertrain for the same reason Willie Sutton robbed banks. He said that's where the money is. This is where the losses are. But you'll appreciate from the last two nights' lectures where I've emphasized the compounding savings from starting downstream that we should really start at the wheels, because every unit of energy we can save at the wheels is going to save about 7 times that much fuel in the tank by turning those compounding losses left to right into compounding savings right to left, just as in the pumping diagram I showed last night. And it's pretty straightforward, even with a doubled efficiency powertrain, where that's only a factor 3.5 gain, not 7, to get a tripled efficiency car this way. Of course, to get the real weight savings like this, you need to multiply weight savings and make them snowball. It used to be that you just do this once. You would make the car as light and slippery as you could think of, so you need less power to run it, and that lends itself to a smaller propulsion system, maybe with new technology, and the chassis parts like brakes and suspension get smaller. And because those things are all smaller, you can have more crush space in the same size car, more space for people and cargo as well. But you might think it costs more for all the obvious reasons. What we do, however, is work the design cycle, or as they say in naval architecture, the design spiral. You go around this loop a few more times, and as you do so, you start multiplying weight savings, because you're not only making parts smaller for lower mechanical loads, you're getting rid of a lot of parts. In a good hybrid, you may, for example, eliminate things like transmission, clutch, flywheel, axles, differentials, drive shaft, universal joint, starter, alternator, they just go away with their weight. Therefore, you get these nonlinear jumps in weight savings. And by the time you get through, you're using so little of the costly light materials, such a small powertrain, And you save so much money in simpler assembly and getting rid of parts and systems that you get a very reasonable and maybe even a lower cost. By the way, if you were wondering how that particular design does in a crash, this is 35 miles an hour into a wall, and you'll notice the whole front end crushes down, so you'd have to replace that, but there's no significant damage, no structural damage to the passenger compartment. Or if you run into a steel SUV twice your weight, each going 30 miles an hour, combined speed 60, you would still be protected from serious injury according to these simulations. I'm not sure there's any car on the road that does that. Now, that's all possible because of an ultralight composite body, which in this case also has an aluminum drop-in subframe in the front so that we can use a variety of propulsion systems and have them all fit the same hardpoints and have a more easy to analyze front-end crush behavior. And this body is incredibly stiff, stiffer than practically any sports car, so it would handle extremely well. And it's designed for an extremely long life, doesn't dent or rust or fatigue. And if you ran into somebody in the parking lot at 6 miles an hour, it would be a fender bouncer, not a fender bender. Now, the really fun part is how you make this body. You notice, first of all, that its heritage is that of an airframe. It's suspended from rings rather than built up from a tub, which is our horse and buggy legacy. So it's extremely strong and stiff. And each of those parts, other than the floor tub, can all be lifted with one hand and no hoist. In fact, the biggest part here on the side that Tom Friedman was lifting, I've been able to lift with one finger. Each part is made with one low-pressure die set. In a steel body, you'd have 10 or 20 times as many parts, each with an average of 4 progressive steel stamping die sets. So you just saved about 99% on the tooling cost. And the parts then snap precisely together like a kid's toy for either gluing or non-adhesive thermal bonding. And because they fit together and align themselves, you don't need the jigs, robots, and welders normally needed to assemble and spot weld the body. And if you lay color in the mold, you get rid of the paint shop. So you end up with at least a 2/5 lower capital cost than the leanest plant in the industry. And the plant's smaller. In fact, the optimal size, around 50,000 a year, almost exactly matches the average nameplate production volume in this country. Now, there's been rapid progress with these kinds of materials. BMW has 60 specialists in Landshut who have bought the world's biggest resin transfer molding press, probably not for amusement. And they said in 2000 it would take them maybe 5 years to get their carbon fiber concept car into series production. It seems to be taking a bit longer, but they're already making over 1,000 a year of various parts for high-end models, and their website praises carbon composites in quite un-Germanic language. Honda and Toyota put their best automotive innovators in charge of their respective carbon fiber airplane businesses. Now, why do you suppose they would do that if it's all about airplanes? Ford has demonstrated remarkable capabilities in the GT with carbon fiber composites and combining them with light metals. And FiberForge, a little spin-off in Colorado from Rocky Mountain Institute, has come up with a process I'll show you videos of in a moment that uses kind of a digital inkjet printer to make a carbon and thermoplastic like nylon plywood. This is from a 1 square meter piece, uniform to better than 10 microns in thickness. And then it's thermoformed to net shape on a 30-minute or 1-minute cycle time, matching the pace of an auto assembly line. So you get 80 to 100% of the performance of hand layup aerospace composites at 10 or 20% of the cost, and with very interesting economics, which have caused a number of automakers and tier ones to become customers. And meanwhile, the company's making things like backpack frames. That's a car seat for a tier one, Johnson Controls, shown at the Detroit Auto Show. And the first step is to make this tailored blank, which combines layers of carbon and or other fibers. For example, you can cut the cost very substantially if you have carbon layers around a cheaper glass center. And this is all run straight off a CAD drawing. And you can make variable thickness parts, different thickness in different places. I've lost the sound again. But I guess hearing the machine will not tell you a whole bunch about it. But it's laying carbon pre-preg and semi-preg tape, and ultimately could be able to lay raw carbon fiber and thermoplastic at about 1.4 meters a second, and then it'll become faster. So because you can control exactly the direction of the fibers in different layers, you can make the strength and stiffness match the load path. So if you want to make that car seat, for example, your computer analysis tells you you need different layers with fibers pointing different ways, and then you make it on the machine to a tailored blank, and then you form it in the next step into the shape you want and into the finished part. So this bowl sample, for example, was made out of a flat piece like this, which could even have non-uniform thickness, thinner in the middle than at the edges. Now, the molding step is quite straightforward, and for ease of visibility, we'll show it here with a fiberglass instead of a carbon fiber part, because it's easier to see white than black. So when you made your tailored blank, you just shuttle it into the oven where it's heated with an array of programmed Wendy's heat lamps. And when it just starts to droop a little from heat, because the nylon or whatever is getting soft, then you shuttle it into your press where you squash it onto a hot die. And the fibers flow where they're supposed to. And then you quench the die by passing cold water through it. And about a minute later, the roast is done, so you reach in with your oven mitts and take it out of the oven. And you trim off any loose bits you don't want, which in this case we weren't at pains to minimize because this was a cheap material, and then you're left with your finished part, and it's that simple. So very high materials efficiency, low scrap, and so on. Now, so far, it will, I think, have become clear that there are some Zen riddles here around making cars. Like, big fuel savings can cost less than small fuel savings. You can tunnel through the cost barrier through integrative design. To leap forward, think backward. Start at the wheels and think back toward the fuel tank. This one is like the Taoist remark that by doing nothing, nothing will be left undone. If you set out to save fuel, you will probably make incremental savings at slowly at some extra cost. But if you set out to make a breakthrough integrative design of a car, you'll save a lot more fuel as a byproduct. And of course, to make cars cheap, you should use costly materials. And to make them safer, you should make them a lot lighter. And to get the best cars, just let the engineers go at it. So you get an automotive leapfrog. Now, to find out what it would cost to make such a car, Fiberforge had its Tier 1 partner put out the design at almost a 500 line item level of detail in anonymous cost packs to the industry to ask what would the supply chain charge to make 50,000 a year. And from that, we learned that the extra cost of ultralighting the car is absolutely trivial. In this case, it's a 1.6% price increase at retail. That's down in the noise. If you made it a gasoline hybrid, it would cost about $2,500 extra because it's hybrid, not because it's ultralight. If you made it a hydrogen fuel cell car, using rather expensive fuel cells by present standards, then it would save not 72% but 83% of the gasoline. But it would still be like buying gasoline at about $2.11 a gallon, which isn't such a bad deal. So if you look at the extra retail price you have to pay for the car versus how efficient it is, we're used to seeing from the National Academy curves showing that you can save a significant amount of energy at a modestly extra price. Some other folks thought, with a better track record, thought you could do better. And we did look at incrementally improved Academy mobiles that would save about a quarter of the fuel and pay back in a year or so. But then we said, wait a minute, suppose we start with a Prius propulsion system at 2004, or what Toyota then projected as 2007 prices, which have turned out to be true. And now let's put it in an ultralight slippery carbon body. For a light truck or a car, the car gets about 92 miles a gallon instead of 55 for the Prius. In other words, almost doubled efficiency, but we're going to the right, not up to the right. The car costs essentially the same. This whole design space on the right, the ultralight space, does not add cost because, again, the cost of your materials are offset by simpler manufacturing and a two or three times smaller propulsion system. Now, there's a backstop technology in case the composites are not ready for prime time, and that's good because I'm materials neutral, and I happen to think composites are a good bet strategically for a bigger leapfrog because of their strategic advantages in manufacturing, but the market will sort out what materials win, and one of those could be ultralight steels. The steel industry says that they can make a, say, Taurus-class vehicle at no extra cost with a 5-star crash rating, twice as efficient, by taking out a lot of weight. And if you then put a Prius-like hybrid powertrain in that at 2007 prices, it would save 80-odd percent as much fuel as the carbon version at lower cost and at roughly a comparable cost per gallon saved. So it would be quite a worthy competitor. And since everybody knows how to make cars out of steel, this at least can give us assurance that we will be able to get most of those fuel savings one way or another. In fact, light steel is what some innovators in Munich used to figure out a 2+2-seat sports car, quite lightweight, very good aerodynamics, and without a hybrid, but with a turbo diesel, they felt that they could get very good Autobahn high speeds, and yet very good miles per gallon also, 87 or 157 in the two models, and it would sell for about 11,000 to 15,000 euros in 2009. Watch this space. Now, the automotive revolution then can start with an excellent hybrid, properly driven, that doubles efficiency, a good deal more if new diesels turn out to be able to keep up with ratcheting air quality rules. If you make it ultralight with better aerodynamics and tires and integrative design, you roughly redouble its efficiency. If you run it on, say, 85% ethanol, preferably from cellulose, you quadruple its oil efficiency again. So far, you've saved a factor 16 on oil per mile, and you could actually use the biofuels, if properly produced, as a way to take carbon out of the air and put them back in tilth where they belong and pay the farmers for that. Now, a good plug-in hybrid, and they may be coming at us sooner than we think, can redouble or better fuel efficiency again by substituting cheaper electricity for ordinary shortish trips. And if you make the power grid set up so that it can buy the distributed storage capacity of the batteries and maybe even own them as a utility asset, then that could be attractive economically. And that's a precursor of the vehicle-to-grid fuel cell play with power plants on wheels. Now, so far, these stages of development can save 97% of the oil per mile that we use now. And, of course, hydrogen fuel cells can also be competitive once you have such efficient cars and can act as very good power plants on wheels and can displace the E85. So they'll get to compete with biofuels and with plug-in hybrids. And hydrogen does actually become a serious competitor when the car gets that efficient. Here's the packaging diagram for that SUV, which takes only a third the normal power to run it. In fact, you can cruise it at 55 miles an hour on the same power to the wheels that a normal car uses on a hot day to run the air conditioner. So with these small hydrogen tanks, which leave plenty of room for people and cargo, you get a normal 330-mile driving range. You don't need any breakthrough in storage. You don't need ultra-high-pressure tanks. Moreover, the fuel cell gets very much smaller, three times smaller, so you can pay three times more per kilowatt for it. So at a normal assumption about cost versus volume, called an 80% experience curve, you would need 32 times less production volume to get the price down to a competitive level, and that'll cut a decade or two off the deployment time. Exactly the same logic, by the way, applies to hybrids, plug-in hybrids, and battery electric vehicles. Whatever your expensive propulsion system is, you'll need several times less of it, so its economics and packaging will become that much easier. And if you just compare, say, this fuel cell design at 35 kilowatts with the much higher fuel cell requirements in other concept cars, whatever you assume the fuel cell system costs, you'll obviously be saving a lot of money, and yet you'll get a better range, which is why we put such emphasis on the physics of the car, especially the weight. So I dare say that whichever automaker goes ultralight first to integrative designs is going to win the fuel cell race. Or to put it another way, an automaker doing research in fuel cell cars will do better to put its money into making the car lighter than trying to make the stack cheaper and the tank smaller, because they'll get to the same place with much less time, money, and risk.
You've been listening to a lecture by Amory Lovins in our MAP Energy series. Amory Lovins was a MAP Ming Visiting Professor for Energy and the Environment at Stanford. This lecture series was sponsored by MAP as part of its commitment to fostering sustainable energy education. For more information, visit MAP online at maproyalty.com. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Chris Hartman. Our website editor was Charlie Batho. The series producer is Sheila Setharaman.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nee on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.